You're listening to HuntertonChamberRadio.com, sponsored by the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce. Our studios are located in the CenturyLink building at 14 Mine Street, Flemington, New Jersey. The content and views of our hosts do not necessarily reflect the views of the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce. To contact our station, call 908-782-7115 or email onair@hunterdon-chamber.org. Thank you to our sponsors and underwriters. Please remember to support them and buy Hunterdon, buy local. Visit www.hunterdonchamberradio.com for a complete listing of our programming. Thank you to our sponsors and underwriters. Please remember to support them and buy Hunterdon, buy local. Visit www.hunterdonchamberradio.com for a complete listing of our programming.
Good afternoon. Program It's the Law. I'm your host, Pat Smits. And as you know, if you listen to the program, I usually talk about cases and topics in law that are coming up and have guests on various law topics. And I know that I announced that I was going to have a guest today dealing with and discussing identity theft. And we may do a little of that, but my guest today is Dave Watts, and I thought we might spend the day. Dave has written a book. It'll be published shortly, and it's called The Accidental PI. And so, of course, it's law-related, and I'd like to learn more about his book, and I'm sure that my listeners would also. And the other thing that Dave is going to do is he's going to present an identity theft program at Hawk Point on September 16th, right? Do I have the right date?
That's it.
September 16th at 7 p.m. And if you're interested, it's going to be a free program, and you'll have to call Dave, or you could call the chamber, or you could call me. My office number is 908-236-7530, and I'll pass that on to Dave. And Dave's cell number is 908-328-5114. And if you're interested in attending the program, give him a call. As I said, it's the 16th of September, and it's going to be on identity theft. And Dave has been on my program before. If you haven't heard identity theft, if you haven't heard that term, you must have been asleep for about the last 5 years, because it is really becoming such a problem. I know, Dave, my one tip, and then I want to talk about your book, and people will say to me, well, why don't you sign the back of your credit cards? And I don't sign the back of my credit cards, and I do have a little slip that says, you know, ask this person for identification, because, you know, anybody who has my credit cards can usually charge. Now, am I just being short-sighted, or am I not protecting myself? But that's the way I do it.
Well, first, thanks for having me today. Of course, Pat, it's a pleasure to be back again. Any measures you take, any security measures you take, including not signing it and putting that little blurb on there about insist upon further identification, anything you do about that is just a good idea. Too many people just naively go along and saying, well, it won't happen to me. But it does.
Well, and often it's not unusual, especially for women, because they'll often ask your mother's maiden name. And there are many people out there, especially now where people are not getting married. So a child's name, in fact, easily could be the mother's maiden name. And so if you get the mother's maiden name, and there are lots of ways people get Social Security numbers. In fact, and I do want to talk about your book, but I am constantly amazed that there happens to be one bank. They will call me, and then they'll ask me for my Social Security number. Well, I mean, I don't know, and I'll say to them, I have no idea where you're calling from, and I never give my Social Security number over the telephone. And they're not happy about it, but I'll say, if you need to contact me, send me something in writing, but I will not and absolutely refuse to give my Social Security number to anybody over the phone.
No, well, you shouldn't. One of the ways that there are several ways, if you don't mind, I'll mention a couple. One of the ways that you can, if you're one of the bad guys, is you can go to Ancestry.com and you can put a name in until you get a hit, and you'll find when a person was born, when they died, with their Social Security number.
Really?
It's right on Ancestry.com. And that's a very cheap monthly rate to pay for getting dead people's Social Security numbers. Another way to do it, which is pretty insidious, is children's Social Security numbers. As you know, nowadays, when kids are born, they receive a Social Security number.
Right.
In my day, it wasn't until you got a job and deductions were taken
exactly.
out. That's when it happened then. Well, please tell me why a child needs to use his Social Security number for any reason until he's 16, 17, 18 years old. Why? There is no reason. What parents should do, and this is the tip of the day, if you're a parent or a grandparent, make sure that the children that you look out for have their Social Security number put on a freeze with the credit bureaus. You contact one of the credit bureaus, any one of them, and they have to notify the other two. And you just say that I want to put this Social Security number in freeze status. Therefore, it cannot be used.
Well,
and then just take it off freeze when they need it.
That is an incredible tip, because you're absolutely right. In fact, one of the things that I fought for years, I was on the Supreme Court Family Practice Committee, and Social Security numbers are on, of course, tax returns, and there is a financial statement that parents have to file with the courts, and it would have the children's Social Security, and it'd have the parents' Social Security, and we now, there is, in fact, it's changed, and now every document that contains confidential information, such as Social Security numbers, has to be redacted. But I can tell you, I'll still see documents from other attorneys, and they're filing them, and they don't redact, or they'll redact on the first page of a tax return. But then if you look at a tax return, it's on top of every page, and they won't redact it. So that, your clue for parents is great. I didn't know that you could tell a credit bureau to freeze a Social Security number.
Yep.
Well, I think that, of course, just leads to identity theft. But one of the things, as I said, there are a lot of women who may use their maiden name, and it could be their mother's name. Remember, if the mother was not married and she names her children and uses her name, that's right there. So it's very easy to get.
One more thing. Social media. You know how people put so much of their own information on social media? I saw last week or so, I saw somebody say, my birthday is next Tuesday. I'll be 49. Okay? So now we have their date of birth.
You're right.
Right? So instead of doing that, do exactly opposite of what your mom told you. Lie. Make it your 48th birthday. Or the wrong day. Make it next Thursday instead. What difference does it make if you do that? And people give too much information away on social media. And social media is where these bad guys go to get that information on people.
Well, and of course they do, and they get more and more sophisticated. They're now hacking in. In fact, I just heard something all the brouhaha with Hillary Clinton's email, but they said if she had not had her separate server, apparently she would have been hacked. So, she had everything through the State Department. Those emails had been hacked.
Am I right when I heard that John Kerry, the present Secretary of State, said that he very calmly and casually said that he was fairly confident that the Chinese had hacked into his emails?
Well,
you shouldn't put anything out there that you don't want somebody else to have.
Well, and however you go to doctor's offices, a hospital, and they're all now, because I know this because they used my husband's information as if I had seen the doctor, sent it all to me. I was amazed at how much information was on there.
Do you remember when, I know you and I probably do, maybe some of your listeners don't, but do you remember when records, consisted of a filing cabinet and 3x5 cards.
Oh, yes.
Well, nowadays it goes into this machine, and then it gets shipped out somewhere up in the cloud somewhere, and a bunch of other people have access to it. You take the Hunterdon County health system. When I visit one doctor, and I go to another doctor, and I go to another doctor, all they have to do is do a couple of clicks, and everybody has access to it. Now, that means that everybody in all those offices have access to it, all of those secretaries. It means that it's out there for hackers to jump into. It's just a different world that we live in. That's why one of the three precepts in my talks that I give is that privacy is dead.
Oh, I absolutely
privacy is dead.
That. I mean, yep. You know, and when you think of what you have to give to the motor vehicle department in order to get a license.
Well, now they want your social security number on a registration.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. So, you know, social security, birth dates, and even to get an airline ticket. You know, you have to give your birth date to get an airline ticket today.
Yes.
So, again, you know, where is all of that stuff going? That bothers me that you should have to give that much information in order to get an airline ticket, and because we don't know who's dealing with it. But what I really want to talk to you about and your book, The Accidental PI. Dave, this is Dave Watts, is my guest today, and I know that... well, Dave, talk and tell our audience a little bit about your background. So, you know, what led up to your even thinking that you could, write some kind of a book?
Well, I started out at 20 years old at Lockheed in Greenbrook, North Plainfield, I guess, on Route 22 as a cost accounting clerk. And then I got laid off New Year's Eve, 1960. The next day was 1961. I got laid off, and I was without a job. So I was walking down the street one day, and I ran into this police officer walking the other direction. He was big and tall. His chest stuck out. His nightstick. He was very impressive, let's put it that way, in terms of a 20-year-old. And he said, "What are you doing hanging around? Don't you have a job? Aren't you going to school? What are you doing?" I said, "No, I'm looking for work." He said, "Well, you know, they're hiring at headquarters." And Pat, that's how it started. I wasn't one of these little kids that grew up that wanted to be
a police officer.
You know, I had no clue what I was going to do. And that's why the book is so aptly named Accidental PI, because that thread goes through the whole thing. Okay. So I became a patrolman on the Plainfield Police Department. In March 21st, 1961, I was 21 years old, but I'm not giving you my date of birth. And I worked about a year and a half, then I got drafted, so I went in the Army. They immediately made me a military policeman, and that's a couple of chapters in the book, too, and which is very interesting. And I got out and went back to the Plainfield Police Department. Shortly thereafter, they saw fit to put me in the Detective Bureau. And I was put into a special unit that dealt with gambling, narcotics, all kinds of vice. I worked there for a couple of years, and at a murder scene, Union County Prosecutor Leo Kaplowitz was standing there. You know how these politicians all hang around, and the chief gets there, and they talk, and they have coffee. So they were standing there. I walked up to him, and I said, "Mr. Prosecutor, any chance you have any openings?" He said, "Anytime I can hire a Plainfield police officer, I will." So the next day, I was hired by the prosecutor's office in Elizabeth, where I worked another couple of years. The long and the short of it is, throughout the turbulent 60s, I was in law enforcement. I was in the Plainfield riot. I experienced all of those things in those days. And when I was a patrolman walking the beat behind all those dark buildings and midnight to 8, we didn't have radios. We had a brass call key that we would walk up to the box and put in the box to call and talk to the desk lieutenant. We were on our own. It was a whole different world. And times have changed, of course, since then. And in the book, it kind of goes along with that.
So would somebody who is interested in the 60s would also have, this would be a book for somebody who kind of wants to see the history of what was happening.
It was very turbulent and not too different than what's going on today in terms of the political situation, in terms of the unrest and the racial tensions and policemen being killed. I mean, John Gleason was trampled to death in Plainfield. He was killed. It was very tragic. I go into detail on that in the book.
Now, who was John Gleason?
John Gleason was a patrolman who was attacked during the riot and killed. He did the right thing. He tried to break up a fight between two people. One guy was chasing another guy around with a hatchet, and John tried to get in between them, and the whole crowd attacked John, and they killed him. It was very tragic. It was the first time in Plainfield's 85-year history of their police department, it was the first time we ever lost anybody on the job in a violent situation. So we were all very, very upset.
Well, I can imagine. Yeah. And at that time, how many officers, do you recall? How many officers were in the department? That was a fairly small department.
Well, in today's terms, yes. But in New Jersey's terms, it really wasn't. We were probably, we were the second largest in Union County. Elizabeth was the largest department. And we were the second largest, being at the west end of the county. We had about 65, 70 officers at the time. And they were all kind of a tough bunch, a little overweight. They were all part of the excuse me, this shouldn't happen.
We may have a caller for your
if Dick Cheney program. If it can happen to Dick Cheney, it can happen to me, right?
That's true.
So anyway, they were all kind of left over from the Second World War in Korea. They'd all served in there. They were guys that came back from the service, and they were serious, you know, about their job. And I fit in a little awkwardly in the beginning, but then I did my 2 years in the service, came back.
Now, why only 2 years?
Because I was drafted. I was drafted. It was pre-Vietnam. I came back and went on the job. Then at the end of the 60s, a lot of the officers became a little disillusioned how things were going. We weren't getting the backing from the politicians that we had hoped or that we kind of expected, nor the respect from the community. So a lot of the guys were looking around for other work, but some of them had 15, 18 years in, and they couldn't walk away from their pension. I had only been there 8 years, and I was 29 years old at the time. So I began looking around. Now, somebody mentioned to me, you know, you should maybe look into insurance investigation. I said, well, it's got investigation in the title. Maybe I will. The only insurance company I knew of was Allstate, so I walked up to Allstate, went up to Allstate in Merry Hill. And you know, Pat, it's this big, high, four-story inside foyer with the glass doors that open, you know, big, a lot of open space. And here's this 50-something woman sitting there, receptionist. I walked up and I said, I'd like to make an application for insurance investigator. She said, well, we have claims adjusters, and they do investigations, and we do have openings because we're opening up an office, a new office in Middlesex County. And you certainly would be welcome to apply. She handed me the application. And she said, what college did you graduate from? I said, well, I went a year to Rutgers. She pulled back. I tugged on the other end. She pulled back the application. She said, well, we only hire college graduates for this job. Now, this is where this accidental PI title comes in, okay? So I turned around and said, well, thank you. And I walked toward the door. And in my mind, I'm thinking, what have I got to lose? She's already told me that they're, you know. So I turned around and I said, you know, all due respect, ma'am, but that is the silliest thing I've ever heard. You mean to tell me you would take a 22-year-old college graduate for this job, investigation job, over somebody who has 8 years of experience of doing investigations, who isn't even 30 years old yet? You really would do that?
Good retort.
So she... You have to picture this lady kind of tapped her pencil and blinked at me a couple of minutes, and then she pointed at me and she said, you sit right down there, young man. So I sat down. Out came this chubby guy, and we went through 4 hours of testing and interviewing and everything else, and I got hired. I got hired. Accidentally, I say, because it's just another one of those things, those turning points in life where had you not spoken up, it wouldn't have happened, and who knows, you know. So that was interesting. I went and worked for Allstate for 6 years. I became a senior casualty adjuster. They kept wanting to promote me to come inside and ride a desk, which I refused to do. And then my wife and I got our first private investigation agency. We decided to go out on our own. Wasn't long before we were working for major insurance companies, law firms, and some of the Fortune 500.
Well, let me see. What year was that? Because I think I'd like to have our audience get a little sense of the kinds of cases when you first started out and how that's changed.
Well, we started out...
What year was that?
76.
Okay.
We started out working anything that would come our way, of course. And there were some matrimonial and domestic cases.
And the reason that's of interest, because I was practicing back in the 70s, and of course, one of the causes of for a complaint, you had to have, at that time, initially, you had to have fault grounds.
Right.
The only no-fault ground was 18-month separation, and most people didn't want to be separated or couldn't afford to separate for 18 months before they filed the divorce. So adultery was a big thing, not a big thing, but it was certainly part of my practice, and one of the reasons and one of the ways that that would be proven is to have a private investigator do the investigation.
Right. Well, we worked on some of those, but it wasn't long before we started working for insurance companies.
Well, with your background, and I would assume that would have been...
Well, I spoke the language. I spoke the language of insurance. Plus, I had the experience of investigations and police work, knowing how to do surveillance from the narcotic squad and the gambling squad. So it was just accidentally a wonderful thing because the insurance companies picked up on us and we worked for them. So I used to send all the matrimonial cases up to Bob Higgins. He was a retired state trooper who said, hey, send them all. I'll be very happy to work on them. And then when we needed help, Bob would come and work with us on other cases. So that's how we sort of got started.
And where did you start your business? Were you still in Plainfield?
No. We moved out to Cokesbury in 1970.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, we moved out here in 1970, 45 years ago. We rented for several years, and then we built our own house. So
you really... In terms of Hunterdon County, although you weren't born here, you certainly were one of the first residents. So where did you start your PI, just out of your home so that you could go all over?
Well, we had an office in Clinton first, and then we got a Pennsylvania license, so we moved our office to Easton for several years. And then we came back to Annandale, and we had a 2,500-square-foot office in Annandale Square, which is that Williamsburg-looking complex. And we were there for a long time until we sold the business.
And when did you sell the business?
1999.
And so what have you been doing since 1999, other than we're going to talk about your book?
Well, we moved to Florida, for one thing. We moved to Captiva Island. We built a house there. And Hurricane Charlie came along and discouraged our presence. Although we didn't lose anything, it really did scare us. So we decided to move back to good old Hunterdon County, which we did. And in that same time period, my five-year non-compete had exhausted itself. So I got a license again. And instead of having a dozen employees, as we did before, it was just me. And I was very happy. My wife jokes, and she said, "You fired me." I said, "Yes, for insubordination." I always tell her that. It's not true, but I always tell her that.
Well, you had to have a very successful business if you had five employees when you sold it.
We had 12 employees.
Excuse me, 12 employees.
Yeah, we had four surveillance vans, and we were working for all the major carriers, plus the Fortune 500. I don't think I should name them on the air, but most of them have just letters.
Okay. Well, using letters, why don't you talk about, because I think people are going to be interested in buying your book, I hope they are, but talk about a couple things that you think were that you put in the book that you really think might be of interest to somebody who's just out there. Because it sounds to me like, even though this is a true story, it almost must read, and I haven't read it yet, it's not out, but it sounds like it might read like a fiction book.
Well, you know, truth is stranger than fiction. I've always believed that. The book is, it's a journey, is what it is. And there are many things as I look back and thought of these and remembered these things, and I put them into the book. There are many of them that are funny. Some are funny, and some are very tragic. The Gleason murder, of course, falls into the latter category, and it was terrible to see his dad, John V. Gleason Sr., in his 80s, standing in front of the Plainfield Police Department with tears running down his cheeks as the hearse drove by, you know, in a salute, the way they do that. Police officers from everywhere lining up.
That's what I asked. Did they back then have police officers coming from all
over? Oh, they came from everywhere. Yes, they were very, very. It was very impressive. They came from everywhere. So that was a very, and I think I vividly explain all of that how it was then, and some people will remember it, I guess. But then there are some funny things that happened too. I mean. When I was in uniform, standing at the corner of Watching Avenue and Front Street in my 20 pounds of raincoat with the cape around the hat and everything, rain's coming down. It's 4:45 in the morning. I'm getting ready to make my ring with that brass key. I looked up Somerset Street, and here comes this figure walking towards me under an umbrella. Way out of context. I mean, nobody should have been out at that hour walking around with an umbrella. What the heck is this guy doing? So he's walking towards me. He's clutching something to his chest. He gets to the curb, my opposite curb from me, and he looks up, sees me, his face brightens, and he rushes across the street. And he says, "Officer, officer." I said, "Good morning. What's up?" He says, "Officer, this is your day. I'm going to make you famous." Now, mm-hmm. Really?
Yeah, and you're worried that he's going to shoot you.
I took a half a step back, and in the book I say, I didn't think he was bringing an umbrella to a gunfight, and he didn't look that dangerous, so I said, "Well, what are you talking about?" And he handed me the umbrella, and he takes this big scrapbook, and he opens it up, and he says, "See, you have discovered the long-lost Lindbergh baby. It's me." And he started showing me the similarity between this infant's ear and his ear and nose and his nose. And surmising I had sort of a deranged person on my hands, I said, "Well, my lieutenant should hear about this." And then I'm thinking to myself, "Oh, my God, it's David Scott. I wonder if he finished his quart of ice cream yet." And they usually took turns snoozing a little bit. I'm not supposed to say that, see, but they took their turns snoozing a little bit between the dispatcher and the lieutenant. So I called on the call box, and I couldn't resist it. I said, "Lieutenant, you and I are going to be famous this morning." Well, I won't give you all of the deleted expletives that came out of the long and the short is of this story is they sent a radio car and they picked the poor guy up. He was an escapee from Lyons Hospital who got a ride on a bread truck. And you never know. Uniform police work is strange. I mean, you run into the weirdest situations.
And now you were patrolling alone.
I was walking alone on a walking beat. Yeah.
Did they always do that back then?
They had them walking beats back then. Yeah, more often.
But only one officer instead of two?
Oh, you walked alone, yes. And you walked behind the stores alone, shaking doors. You know what I mean? Shaking
right,
to see whether or not the door
sure
was locked.
Everything was locked.
One of the particular alleys you walked down, you walked about 50 feet down this alley. Then you made a left turn in the dark, a very dim light there. You made a left turn in the dark to go all the way get that one door at the end. So I walked down one night with my flashlight leading the way, and I made my turn. And there's a guy down there at the end, flashing a light back at me.
Wow.
Well, it was a mirror that the store owner had put out there at just the right angle. I almost shot that guy, you know.
Oh, I can imagine. But luckily, if you had, it wouldn't have bounced back.
Funny things happen. So.
Well, but there were some scary things going on. You're right. I don't think that... There seem to be different now. I mean, although I guess not when you talk about Ferguson and you see what's happened in Baltimore and some of these other areas. I did not live in New Jersey during the riots in Plainfield or Newark.
Newark, yeah.
I wasn't here in the late 60s. So, but I was on college campuses, so I have a pretty good sense of what was going on.
Students for a Democratic Society. You remember that one?
Well, I certainly do.
Now, don't admit anything.
I'm not admitting a thing. However, SDS was, yes, I know some of the founders and very familiar with that organization. But we won't go there. Let's talk a little bit more. Actually, I think we better take a short break because we do have some sponsors and we want to give them their due. And my guest today, if you've just tuned in, is David Watts. And David has had a wealth of experience, military police, police officer in Plainfield. Now, did you ever make detective or?
Yeah, we were in the detective bureau, right? And then before I had a chance to get promoted to sergeant or anything like that, I went to the prosecutor's office.
The prosecutor's office. And for people that don't understand, the prosecutor's offices today and for many, many years, they have their own investigators. And so that they work along with police departments in many of the cities, but they have to investigate. For example, if there's someone and crimes are committed, they do the investigation. They're doing a lot of work in order to see whether or not somebody is going to be presented for an indictment and what kind of charges. And but to have been a police officer, I guess most of the investigators in the prosecutor's office really have worked as police officers.
Usually, yes.
They?
I would say
I would think so. I don't know how you would become an investigator in the prosecutor's office without that kind of background. But in any event, we'll be back in just a couple, about a minute.
Unionville Vineyards is the perfect destination for wine tastings and tours, corporate events, birthday parties, or your special day. Located in East Amwell, New Jersey, Unionville Vineyards offers an escape from the rush of daily life and a chance to relax in the beautiful countryside. Our tasting room is open 7 days a week, 12 to 5 p.m., excluding major holidays. For more information, contact us at unionvillevineyards.com or call us at 908-788-0400.
Did you know that 1 in 5 people are affected by mental illness? NAMI Hunterdon is the locally affiliate for NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. We are all volunteers, and all our programs are free of charge. We offer Family to Family, a 12-week course for families that have an adult member with a mental illness. Another popular program is In Our Own Voice, where individuals who are living with mental illness discuss their challenges and their progress in overcoming those challenges. Another course we offer is Basics, a 6-week course for families with a child or an adolescent who has experienced mental illness. We also have a monthly support group for families on the third Thursday of every month. Please call NAMI Hunterdon at 908-284-0500 for more information about any of our programs or to join. NAMI Hunterdon, the voice for mental health.
I'm Andy Ross. I'm a CPA with the accounting firm of Bedard Corking Company, and I joined the chamber to interact with new chamber members and expand our mutual needs for business networking and giving back to the Hunterdon business community.
Hunterdon Chamber of Commerce, building business, one business at a time.
Hi, we're back. The program, It's the Law. I'm your host, Pat Smits. Today, my guest is David Watts, and he's written a book, The Accidental PI, A Private Investigator's 50-Year Search for the Facts. It will be in bookstores and online in the fall. And let me just read a couple excerpts of people who have read the book and would certainly know whether or not this is right on. And, for example, one is the blurb, Master Investigator Becomes Master Storyteller. Dave had me chuckling, nodding my head, honest, painful, and even funny. And this was from written by Private Investigator Patrick Chase. He's a Florida certified investigator, and he was also a captain in the Minnesota State Police, retired. Another blurb, an accurate description of police work and private investigations, fraud, corporate greed, murder, sex, and all true. And that was another private investigator, Robert Higgins, and he owns a detective agency here in New Jersey and was also a sergeant in the New Jersey State Police. And the kudos go on and on. And I'm pleased to have my guest today, and we will also be and have talked a little bit about identity theft. I'm going to ask Dave if there's anything in his book about identity theft, but if you didn't tune in earlier, Dave is going to be putting on a program on identity theft, and it will be open to the first 50 people, and it is going to be on September 16th at Hawk Point, and you can call if you're interested in attending. You can call Dave at 908-328-5114, or you can call my law office, 908-236-7530, and I'll pass that information on to Dave. So, Dave, let's talk about, you weren't dealing with identity theft back in the 1960s, were you?
No, not at all. It's a new phenomenon, relatively new phenomenon, I would say. But we didn't have the technology. It wasn't available to the hackers either.
Very interesting. So, really, would you say that it was after the inception of the Internet, and that is what has made it so easy?
Well, one of the slides in my presentation is a quotation from Professor Charles Percy Snow, who was a physicist and a philanthropist and an author in Great Britain. You might refer to him, you might consider him to be England's counter to Albert Einstein, a very bright man. He died in 1980, okay? But this is his quote. Technology is a queer thing. While on the one hand, it gives us great gifts, with the other, it stabs us in the back. Now, he said that in 1980, which was really before the Internet got up and running real strong, even though Al Gore invented it. we know that it took a while before the everyday person could get on the Internet and do what we
right.
Google as we do today. So it wasn't back then, but it certainly is a problem, and technology is the catalyst that puts it all together.
Well, I do remember, though, back, it must have been sometime, maybe it was in the 90s, when, for example, I took a flight out of Newark Airport and made a phone call, and remember we had calling cards then.
Oh, yeah.
And I had it memorized, so I just punched it in and came back a few days later and couldn't make a call on my card, and it was because someone had somehow intercepted that. Now, whether they had something on the payphone, remember the days we had payphones?
Yeah, I remember those.
So obviously it was before I had a cell phone. But it was amazing that, I don't know whether they used binoculars, if they had something on the phone, but certainly, enterprising people have been trying to steal identity for a long time. And I did find out from the phone company that the reason they put the block on my card is that $6,000 worth of calls have been made in a span of like 24 hours.
Mostly international, I would think.
They were all international.
Yes, that was very common back then.
So what kinds of investigations, I want you to talk about what you've talked in the book, but what kinds of investigations? What were people worried about in New Jersey that they needed to investigate? For example, insurance companies. When you were working for an insurance company, what kinds of investigations would you do?
Well, the insurance company claims department, again, that I had experience in for 6 years before we had our license, but those claims departments would examine their files, and they would come up with flags. They would say, well, this doesn't fit. This person is complaining about soft tissue injury 2 years after the accident. Shouldn't be more than 6 months. Let's have him examined. So they sent him to what they call an independent medical exam, an IME. And the doctor examines them and reports back to the insurance company, a copy of which goes to the plaintiff's attorney as well. But it indicates a person has calluses on his hands. He has good muscle tone. It doesn't seem, the doctor might say, it doesn't seem to me that he is suffering from the injury that he claims. There was a reason why they wanted to get an investigation. So then they would assign us to the case, and we would, using our skills in the field, again, going back to the police work, we would use our van and follow these people around and take videotape and still shots of them and file the reports, and then we would testify and go to court, and that's the way it worked.
In other words, if the guy who said he had to walk around on crutches and you found him up putting a new roof on his house, that might be a little bit suspicious.
Sounds like many of the cases.
Really?
Really.
What about working for some of the other large corporations? Anything? Did you ever work for any of the pharmaceutical companies, for example?
Yes. Well, those with initials.
Okay. So,
in the first third of the alphabet.
give me an example of something that you would have been asked to do for one of the pharmaceutical companies.
Okay. The security director in this one case called us, and they suspected that a vice president was taking kickbacks. They suspected that because a young auditor came to the security department reporting that he had that suspicion and reported it to his supervisor, who then told him, don't worry about it. Forget about it. That's a New Jersey term. Hey, forget about it.
Forget about
only
it.
He really meant forget about it. And the young auditor thought that there was something going on, and he was upset about it. So he went to the security manager who assigned us to the case. He said, we're going to be working inside here, but we'd like you to do some outside work. So we put the house under surveillance. Now, this is a chap making $300,000 a year then, with nice perks, maybe another $100,000 in benefits. So he was doing very well back in the 1990s. So we watched his house, and we recorded everything. Not recorded. We wrote down everything that we saw. And one day, one Saturday morning, the garage door was open, and there was a little red MG sports car, kit car, they call it a kit car, where it's not the genuine car.
Right.
But it was in the garage, and they were working on it. So we wrote that down, among the many other things that we wrote down. And then one day, working several weeks on this, one day that little kit car was outside, and it had license plates on it. Well, we ran the license plate, which gave us the VIN number. We ran the VIN number, which gave us the seller. We reported this to the security. I'm trying not to use his name. Reported it to the security manager, who then went to that seller in Chicago and got a copy of the check that was written for the sale of the vehicle. The problem is, the check was written by a vendor of the pharmaceutical company to purchase the car for the vice president.
Which was the kickback.
That was the kickback.
So it wasn't cash, which
they gave him a little sports car for his for his one kid in college. Yeah, and here's a man making $300,000-$400,000 a year that lost his job for a $25,000 kit car. Very sad. Very sad.
Well, very sad that someone, you know, who didn't need it was just so greedy that he would do something like that. I mean, look, nobody should steal, don't get me wrong. On the other hand, if somebody steals a loaf of bread because they're starving, you know, that, in my mind, that's a little different.
Well, there is a difference, isn't there?
There is. I think there is.
Yeah.
And
so that was an example. And there were many, many other cases where they would use us for different things. When, I will say this, when Colgate-Palmolive put the women's games on in Madison Square Garden, I was called upon to put together a team to go and do executive protection on Colgate's executives in the section that they sat in, because it was compulsory. They had to go and watch the games. You know, they were. It was Colgate.
Right.
So I hired the Reddington Township Police Department. I remember when Chief Stadnick looked out his window when I picked up half a dozen of his guys, and he says, "Where the heck are they going?" It was all with permission,
right,
by the way.
Course.
It was a big joke. But we took them in, and we did executive protection on the executives. At one point, the security director, Pat Keefe, and I were walking around. It was circular, the Madison Square Garden, the hallways. And a police detective ran by, yelling into his radio and saying there's a shooting on the floor below. So we got our radios and told our guys to tighten up and watch what's going on, because there's something going on. The next guy came by, a detective, slowed down and explained to us that they hadn't caught the guy yet. Well, we were walking with the president of Colgate at the time. Pat grabbed one elbow, I grabbed the other, and we walked him through the nearest door, which happened to be a ladies' room. So we got him off the hallway and into a ladies' room.
And hopefully there were no ladies in there.
So those are the, you know, interesting right. kind of stuff. Nothing happened with that. I mean, they caught the guy. But just fun things to be involved in. We also worked for Whitney Houston's attorney on cases where fraudsters would try to get over on the family. One time, two guys walked into Tiffany's in Manhattan and convinced the salesperson that they were there to pick up the jewelry that Whitney had picked out. They
Wow.
didn't remember that Whitney had been there, because, of course, she hadn't. So these guys chose the jewelry they wanted and actually walked out with it, put it on Whitney's account. I thought it was pretty bold.
Wow. And pretty dumb.
But they did it.
At the store. You would think something like Tiffany's would have, you know, wouldn't have been the first time somebody tried to scam them.
Well, the dumb part about it was that they left some information that tied it to them, and then the attorney gave me the information. We found the guys in Union, New Jersey, and turned it over to the Union Police Department, and they caught him. So, but different kinds of
right.
different kinds of cases. Whenever anything unusual would come up, they would call us.
So you actually did a whole variety. In other words, they knew that if there was something from a detail of protection, private protection, to you know, some of the most, you know, big fraud cases. Tell me something more about any other of the fraud cases. How about, well, let's get a little of the sex. What's the sex in the story?
Oh, okay. Let me think about which one. Okay.
Oh, there's so many.
Yeah,
you'll have a lot of readers.
There were a few. Well, there was a doctor in Fort Myers when we were living there. How should I start this? Okay. I was called by Wilbur Smith, who was a former mayor of Fort Myers, Florida. Terrific defense attorney. Very good. He goes into court with alligator shoes on, alligator boots. In fact, there's a 14-foot stuffed alligator in his office as soon as you walk in. A character, but a very, very good attorney. He called me and said, there's a doctor, I won't name him, who is being charged with sexual assault, with rape. And you got to hear this case, Dave. So I went to his office, and I'm sitting in the outside office when this doctor and his wife came in. And he was a very good-looking man in his 50s, gray, steely hair, full head of hair. And his wife was kind of chunky and short and mousy. Nice lady. You know, they just didn't seem like they fit together. At least maybe in high school things were different, but now they didn't look like. She sat there with her hands folded and her head down. He looked very contrite. they didn't know who I was at first, and then they realized that I was the investigator they were going to hire. So we went into the office, and the doctor explained what happened. We got a phone call at the office that this woman was having terrible, terrible nerve pain, and she needed to see a doctor after work. So the doctor made an exception, and he allowed her to be examined. She came into the office, and the office staff went home, and he was there alone with her. Well, he says, boy, did she seduce me. And she claims that he drugged her and raped her. And he said he did no such thing, that she had.
It was consensual.
He says it was consensual. Well, there's such a thing called the Rape Shield Law.
Right.
Which means...
Yeah, explain that to our listeners.
Well, I'll do it the best I can. You're the attorney, but I'll do it the best I can. In defense of people who are accused with rape, you cannot go after the victim and use their past history of sexual activity against them.
Right. In other words, you can't put the victim on trial. And that's the way, prior to the Rape Shield Law, that's exactly what would happen.
That was the defense.
The defense was always, they would pull everybody out of the woodwork with respect to her past sexual history.
Right.
And in fact, there would even be, in certain cases, you know, people she didn't know who would be coming in and testifying. But that was the way that they tried to balance the scale.
Right.
So go on with your...
Right. So Wilbur sat me down, and we decided what our strategy was going to be. But I'm not going to go into some of the details because I don't want to embarrass everybody, but the way that the facts came out of this situation seemed as if this woman was trying to really trap this guy, the doctor. We listened to the tape recordings of the police when the police asked her to invite him over to the house if he called. Well, he called. He wanted another session, I guess, with her. So they were ready. They were hiding behind a curtain with the tape recorder going when the doctor came. And the doctor came in. Now, before the doctor got there, the woman said to the officers, well, suppose I get him into the bedroom. And they said, no, we're not going to do that. Well, do you think I should wear something more revealing? No, we're not going to do that. So it was clear from the recordings that that she was really getting into this about catching him, quote, unquote. It was very suspicious. So going beyond that, I did some background work on her. I found out she'd been married four times before, and that one of her husbands, who died, was married to a woman in New York City. I spoke to her. She said that, oh, yes, well, Carol was quite an operative. I said, well, what do you mean? This doesn't have to do with Rape Shield. It has to do with reputation otherwise.
Right.
Well, when Carol wanted to apply for welfare, she was living across the street with my husband. And our apartment was a lot worse than theirs. So she wanted to use our address so that when the social worker came, he would be inspecting our crummy apartment so that she could get welfare. And there were a lot of other things. I interviewed this woman's boyfriend who said she asked him one time, do you know any good doctors I can sue? I've run out of money. So all of this came out in the depositions. And ultimately what happened with this case, the doctor lost his license, as he should have. She dropped the criminal charge. She never filed a civil suit because in the deposition it was laid out for her and the two prosecutors that were there just exactly what we had. And it kind of went away. The doctor was not criminally prosecuted further, but he had to give up his license.
Well, that's, you know, even that, so it wasn't just suspended. It was actually he lost his license because, of course, from the AMA's position,
you just don't do that.
You don't have sex with a patient.
No.
You know, same problem, and, you know, I could give you a number of situations where lawyers got involved with clients,
right.
And, you know, there's the same prohibition. Well, we're starting to run out of time. My guest today, and I think I can't wait to read your book.
I can't wait either. I'm waiting for it to come out. It may not be till Christmas now.
Really?
So yeah. Well, we have some more things to do. I've contacted the families of all of the guys that I used to work with because they're gone. Okay.
Right.
They would be in their 80s and 90s, but they're gone. So the families are providing me with some great photographs to be put in the center of the book. So I can't not accept those in order to do this.
Well, that's terrific. But the book is Accidental PI, and hopefully it'll come out before Christmas. It would be sounds like a great read. It would be actually a great book to take down to the shore and sit on the beach and read. And I'm sure that. You know, I've known Dave for a long time. In fact, you know, we don't have time today, but I've been involved in a case, and there are times where it is really necessary to get a private investigator. The case that I took over had to do with someone who claimed she had no money and, in fact, was suing a doctor for child support. He did father the child. But needless to say, she was not only trying to get much more money from him than she should have. She had assets that, and in fact, when I say doctor, at the time he was a medical student, so he had nothing. And she owned a couple of condos, and you know she had done the same kind of fraud with you know other situations. And but without that initial information, we would never have been able to take. And do what we needed to do legally. So I certainly know how important it can be to get that information. And for example, in the doctor's case, even though you couldn't use certain things because of the rape shield, he wasn't prosecuted. And he didn't get sued, which would have been a situation where I'm not even sure if his insurance would have covered him. I mean, that's the problem. And we don't have time to talk about insurance. But, you know, if it is an intentional tort, you know, people do not have
insurance.
Could be
insurance. An exception to that.
It usually is an exception. So, Dave, thank you again for being a great guest. We'll be back after playing a couple spots and the news. And thank you again, and we'll be back with the sports guys.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Joe Peters of Weikert Realtors. Buying or selling a property can be one of the most expensive undertakings you face in your lifetime, and selecting the right realtor to help you through this process can dramatically affect your success or your failure. I have personally helped hundreds of buyers and sellers through this process in achieving their dreams and goals in 100 in Somerset County areas over the past 10 years. I believe that this experience should be a smooth, seamless one for you and not a roller coaster ride. But the best judgment as to whether or not I deliver this to my customers is their reactions in their own words.
One of the things we liked about Joe was that he would return calls within minutes if he wasn't able to pick up.
You know, Joe guided us through the process of selling our home and made a complicated transaction appear seamless.
How do I accomplish this? By approaching every transaction from a business perspective. Initially, I try to fully understand your goals and dreams and make them my own. Then, I go out and take the mass amounts of data that we have and distill them down to a few understandable action points to be considered. Finally, I control the entire process through technology to ensure that we're not going to hit any speed bumps along the way. The end result to you is a smooth, rewarding customer experience. Let me show you how to take my level of professional expertise and put it to work for you in achieving your real estate goals and dreams. I can be reached at 908-238-0118. Thanks for your time.